Brian Stanton here with some ASAP Frontline today in the Grand Hyatt in Washington, D.C. Some little bit of background noise, maybe an escalator, maybe another meeting or two going on, maybe a little background music, but it's going to all make for a great podcast here with Dr. Rebecca Parker, President of the American College of Emergency Physicians, really leading the way, carrying on with a couple of things from Dr. Jay Kaplan, and is also blazing her own trail and doing some fantastic stuff. And today we want to talk about a talk at Leadership and Advocacy on resiliency, burnout, leadership, and something I think that's very important, because all things that we need to do as emergency physicians, not only getting in there and being those that lead the way and do the things and be the change we want to see, but also how do we make sure that we are there for future generations and making sure we can take care of our patients. So Dr. Parker, thank you for joining me, and give us a little background on where this came from, where this talk came from, and what got you interested in it.
Well, thanks for having me, Ryan. And the talk came from the realization personally by myself, and I think as our specialty, that the rates of physician burnout were increasing and emergency medicine leads the list on specialties. So we needed to come together and think about how can we address the issue, the syndrome of burnout, and look at the positive way to look at this, which is really about resiliency. Burnout has a negative connotation. It's almost as if you can't handle it, when in reality, we're in a very stressful environment, and what we need is time to recharge and some other tactics to become resilient in our profession of medicine. And that's a lot about what my talk is about.
Why is it that, you know, you look at the list and you see, and it may seem some obvious, but, you know, the ones that lead the list are always those that are really caring for the sickest of the sick, you know, the critical care, your pulmonologist, ICU, trauma, emergency medicine. Why is it that we in those fields are most vulnerable to this burnout, and even to the point of being potentially diagnosed as PTSD?
Well, when you look at the syndrome of burnout, which has actually been studied by psychologists, Dr. Maslach out of Stanford has done quite a bit of work on this and actually has an inventory you can take of yourself of a burnout index, MBI. And when you look at what causes that syndrome, it has to do with high stress with low control. And we are in a high stress, sometimes the highest stress environments. And if we don't have some control over our work environment, take some control over the personal side, take some time to step back, reflect, and go through the debriefing that we know we need to do after mass casualty events, we're going to go down that path. And so it's important to, first of all, acknowledge that this syndrome does exist, but that secondly, there are tactics to be able to reverse the trend and become a resilient physician. I mean, look, we picked a high stress environment. All physicians did. We want that stress. We take it as we chose a profession of medicine because we have passion for helping people, and that comes with a high-stress environment. So things such as finding your passion, touching base back with yourself of why did I become a doctor? Why am I doing this? And connecting those dots back to that spiritual side, coupled with taking care of yourself and your family, physically, emotionally, taking those breaks, and doing things outside of the clinical practice like leadership, like an advocacy conference where we're at today, can be ways to help you through to continue this high-stress mission and calling that we all picked, which is called medicine.
What are some of the things that folks need to look for that are going to maybe tip you off? Because that's one of the difficult things that physicians have is, you know, we are good physicians treating others, but we aren't necessarily good patients. We're not really good. I don't know that we're really good in most cases taking inventory of ourselves. What are the things that we need to look for to kind of give us an idea of, to give us, you know, maybe tip us off that we're getting right there towards the edge of that burnout?
Well, it's interesting because if you take the survey itself, it has some clues in it. So things like depersonalization, you know, some of the not feeling connected to the patient or getting cynical about the patients you're seeing, things such as frankly, PTSD-like symptoms. Waking up in the middle of the night still thinking about that case or can't let go of a situation that was happening in that clinical environment. And also then sort of not being able to let go of it, sort of that recurrent pattern. I mean, as you hear these descriptions, we know as clinicians that sounds a little bit like PTSD. So those kinds of things are crucial. And it's important, too, to realize that physicians have a higher suicide rate. In fact, women more than men, men are about 1.5 times the rate to commit suicide compared to the general population, and women are over 2 times. So it's important that we also sort of watch each other and do those interventions, and our families watch us as well, to look for signs of depression and those thoughts about suicide.
When it comes to the leadership aspect of it, you know, one of the keys here, this conference is leadership and advocacy, and then Leadership Day. What is the role of leadership, and what toll does it take to be in leadership roles within your hospital and within your emergency department? Also, what are some of the benefits of that when it comes to this sort of staving off burnout and you know, increasing longevity?
So when you look back to the formula of high stress with low control, sort of low quality in your life and your workplace, I think a conference like this can really help with the second aspect of trying to get more control over your practice environment and have an impact in a different way. I see this leadership and advocacy conference having a through line with resiliency. So tonight we have a guest speaker, Z-Dog, who many people know, and I've asked him to think about his comments to be in the framework of resiliency and how sort of taking some control over our practice environment, whether it be at that local level as a leader, as a director, or as an active member of your department, or coming up on Capitol Hill to tell the stories of our patients and the things that we need to deliver care at the bedside. Those are ways to battle back the burnout part, but also get back into that world of resiliency, of that positivity. Our day on Wednesday includes things such as how to be a leader, how to think about implicit bias, how does social media play in as a leader, how can it be a supportive network, as we've seen in our groups such as EM Docs or Physicians Moms Group, how can we use that as physicians to communicate and support each other, to things such as how to get out and do public relations, how can you do that to have a positive effect on your environment. And all those things are empowering and helpful in addressing that paradigm of a high demand specialty that we have all been called to, with the controlling part of our work environment and also in our personal life of fulfillment, of that spiritual fulfillment of making a difference.
So somebody sitting out there right now, you know, maybe they just graduated, or maybe they've been out for years in their community physician, and think about, what can I do? What are the things that I can personally, you know, think about outside of my daily hours in the emergency department? Give some tips, some ideas for those folks out there of how they get involved more, get into leadership, do things that are outside that traditional scope of practice, as we would, I guess, consider it.
So a couple things. I think, you need to know you're not alone. We all feel these stresses and are coping with them in different mechanisms. So I think a couple of tips. One is the spirituality piece of getting back to, why did you go into medicine? Why did you pick the profession? Even taking your group out together and going and having a beer and pizza and talking about, why did you become a doctor? What was the last great case you had where you said, I'm really glad I'm doing this? This really makes it worthwhile. I think making sure you're taking time off. When you take a vacation, really take a vacation. We're all guilty of doing things while we're on vacation. No, you need that break. We're no longer in medical school. We're no longer residents. You need that time away. Making sure that your family, your significant other, your partners are getting the attention when you're away from work. Because when you're gone, they're proud of you. They're proud of the things you're doing. When you're home, be sure you're unplugging and spending time with them, because they love you and they're there to support you and want to be your support network. And then I think finding things outside of medicine that encourage your passion. I just gave a talk on this in Springfield, Illinois, and some of the docs said, oh, I bike, I do this other activity. One guy actually raises bees and makes honey, and he brought me a bottle an ASAP member of his honey that he does. Of course, he didn't tell me that during the lecture. He came up afterwards because that would have been a great example of something outside the box. Somebody else collects razors. It just finds it interesting, you know. So just recognizing you're a person too beyond medicine, and finding those things that interest you, whether it could also be an advocacy with your state chapter or that, which is something I found to be fulfilling outside of my daily clinical practice. So connecting those dots are a couple ways you can do that, those things.
Well, there's plenty of opportunities out there. And in a lot of times I hear, you know, a state chapter, physicians, like, I don't know what I can do or what is ASAP doing to help with this. And, you know, there's some, give us some good ideas about opportunities within ASAP for leadership to, you know, things that folks can do, not only kind of locally, but also on the national level to get involved and to do more, not only for themselves, but for our profession.
Well, absolutely. And I think as you're in your practice environment, you're close to the patients. And that's what legislators want to hear about. That's what policymakers want to hear about. So when you get into a situation where you may see, you know, whether it's a heroin overdose that you couldn't get follow-up for, or it was a prescription database that was restricting you in terms of access, or maybe there's a patient's story in terms of mental health or health issues. You know, taking those stories and bringing them to the state chapter, to those advocacy days, and helping potentially form policy that can make a difference for those patients, I think that's what that state chapter is meant for, and that's what the national organization is meant for. It's supposed to be a vehicle for us to be able to tell our patients' stories and to make a difference.
What resources are out there available from the American College of Emergency Physicians when it comes to the idea behind resiliency as well as leadership to really help kind of boost that? Because there's a lot of people that have gone before us that have really laid down some fantastic groundwork, made it pretty easy for most of us to really get going. What are some things that are out there that folks can turn to help get a good start?
Well, we just co-hosted a wellness summit with all the other organizations in emergency medicine, and Dr. Jay Kaplan chaired that from the ASAP side, and we had that meeting in Dallas. That was just a couple of weeks ago. So they're in process of putting together some of the ideas into white papers, into deliverable tactics to share with the community at large. So that's coming. We also have a wellness section and a well-being committee, and those resources are on our website. We actually have a wellness sort of book that's available there to key off some ideas on sort of taking care of yourself and other ideas on resiliency. And then we had our wellness week for the second time this year. That will happen again next year, once again started by Dr. Jay Kaplan. So we hope that folks participate, and it's a time to pause and remember that we need to take care of ourselves and everyone around us in order to be healthy and the best physicians we can be for our patients.
So I rode up here, I got on the airplane in Lexington, and sitting right behind me is Dr. Steve Stack, and so past president of the American Medical Association, and he was coming up here to assist with some of your one of the big things that you pushed for that we talked about in Vegas in the fall was diversity in emergency medicine and medicine. Give us some ideas, some things that are going on with that. I mean, it sounds like you've brought some big guns to bear if you've got the former president of the AMA coming up here to help push this forward.
Well, Steve's a good friend, and we've been leaders together since we were residents, so I'm so proud of what he's done in emergency medicine, and so proud of him as well. So I knew he was finishing some of his AMA duties and tapped him to be involved with the project. And Steve's been supportive from the very beginning, by the way, when we had our Diversity and Inclusion Summit. So our task force is in mid-cycle with Dr. Asia Lifridge leading that charge and is coming up with some really terrific ideas on diversity and inclusion, from creating an EMF grant to look at research when it comes to health disparities, to rolling out training and implicit bias or unconscious bias when it comes to diversity and inclusion, to looking at the pay discrepancy between men and women and other projects. Steve specifically is looking at leadership and leadership tracks within our national organization and the council and in our board, and how that works and how can we break down barriers to involve other people as well. Our state chapters had a long conversation about this on Sunday, about opening opportunities at that level, including speaking opportunities and development opportunities, because that's where we get our national leaders, is out of our state chapters and state opportunities. So I think it's clear to everyone that our population is becoming more and more diverse. Our physicians are becoming more and more diverse through a variety of efforts, including the AAMC. And as we grow and mature as a specialty, we're going to be more diverse, and it makes us stronger to be united and be together. And it goes back to the resiliency part of our conversation, that that's a part of who we are as people. And if we can help embrace each other as full persons, we'll be more resilient in our practices.
What are the biggest challenges that we're going to face in terms of diversity in emergency medicine? Because I feel like in medicine that, you know, that it's wide open. That to me, I feel like there's very little, you know, I don't care who I work with or where they come from or what they believe or whatnot, as long as we're all in this in the same, we're all in the same boat trying to treat our patients. But there are, I mean, it's everything from the biases of patients to the staff to other physicians. What are the challenges we're going to face, or the biggest challenges facing in diversity in emergency medicine?
Well, I think for emergency medicine, we have a couple challenges. One is that even though women have been almost half of the medical school class of graduates in the last 20 years, we still only have 25% of our attendings as women physicians and only a third of our residents. So we're not capturing women into our specialty. And the other piece is our pipeline for minorities. We're very small. Our percentages are very small for minorities. So we have pipeline work to do to capture the students that are coming into medical schools into emergency medicine. So some of the work the task force is doing is looking at that. And then when you get into the clinical practice side, there are challenges in terms of looking at our own biases when we look at different populations and different cultures, and even to how people describe symptoms or how they might try different treatments and what their own biases are in their cultures. And I think as we do more of this work, that's part of the health disparity conversation, and part of the training the AAMC is creating is understanding these different cultures. And then also, what do you do if someone is a patient who says, you know, I don't want that woman doctor, I don't want this kind of doctor, that kind of doctor, and how do you deal with that as a professional? There was some recent conversation about Muslim faith, and a pregnancy patient with a male physician was all that was sort of available on some of our social media channels. And some of our colleagues said, hey, look, actually in the Muslim belief, if that's what's available, it's okay. So understanding that as a clinician, as a male clinician, if you run into that situation, I'm the only doctor with a woman, you can help your patients and their families make the best decision possible within their cultural beliefs. So those are nuances to the practice of medicine, the practice of emergency medicine. And because we see everybody 24/7, 365, we're going to see all different kinds of people. We're going to need to be prepared to take care of all different types, along with being ready to take care of each other from all different backgrounds as well.
It is a challenge. And I've had that same situation where, you know, you have folks coming and saying, especially with gynecologic issues of, is there not a female physician here? And those conversations can be difficult, because as a physician, you know, you're sitting there thinking, well, I'm the only doc here. You came to see me. I didn't send out an invitation for you. And I think that communication and understanding is difficult. Understanding, you know, that communication is huge. I teach my students all the time that you know, depending on where somebody is from, you know, their background, their life experiences, completely dictates what they say. And if you see a certain person from a certain population in the emergency room, you might as well go ahead and call a surgeon, because that population never comes in. They only come in when there's the stuff has hit the fan. It's kind of like the World War II veterans. They're only coming into the emergency room when, you know, you might as well have everything ready. How do we as physicians prepare ourselves for that better, prepare ourselves for that diversity and understanding of those populations that we see in the emergency room? And I think that can be especially difficult when we have, if depending on where you grew up, depending on where you trained, and then moving somewhere else in the country where it may be totally different. I mean, I think we all have a little bit of different experiences based on where in the country you practice. Practicing in Lexington is very different than Santa Monica, which is very different from Washington State, which is very different from San Antonio. What are some good tips on folks on how we as physicians prepare ourselves for a diverse population, which is getting more diverse every day?
So I think right now we have a lot of anecdotal and personal experiences. So I trained actually on the border of Mexico and Texas and do speak Spanish. And so my residency had a lot of the population from the culture across the border. And so things on how they described pain or how culturally they dealt with bad news, those were things I had to learn. For example, you know, pain in Spanish is more burning or hot or strong. Those are the types of words, if you directly translate them, that are used for pain. They're not our types of pain descriptions. I also practice on the south side of Chicago. So the culture there about how people describe their symptoms from the African-American community, the prevalence of hypertension, malignant hypertension with, you know, dialysis patients and aneurysms and dissections. And so it changed the practice pattern depending on that population you were in. So for me personally, I've learned those cultures as I survived in them and saw the patients. I think part of the work of our task force of SAM's Academy in Diversity in Emergency Medicine is looking at those health disparities and trying to quantify some of those conversations and some of those patterns. There's actually a book published recently in the last year or so on quality in emergency medicine on health disparities by Marcus Martin and one of their editors, Cheryl Heron's on our task force. And they've gone through and actually done case studies on different cultures, whether it be, as I described, or LGBTQ, homelessness, or socioeconomic, et cetera. It's really a terrific book. So we're starting that piece and looking at specifically in emergency medicine. Some of our researchers and our colleagues at SIEM are doing that work. So I think we need to spread that information and then spread our knowledge and share the stories of what we're learning about. The WMC is currently training medical students in some of that within the curriculum, and we would like to lift some of that, frankly, and bring it into the community practice so that we can catch up on some of the things that we know. So I look forward to helping to distribute that information that's out there, and that is the third objective of the task force.
It seems like in medical school we spend, you know, years learning the medicine and the medicine of the human body and the science of the human body. And then once we get into the practice of medicine, it's learning about the human element, which is everything else that goes into healthcare and medicine. And so much of what we do isn't about a medicine and isn't about a lab or something like that. It's about conversations and education and relationships and understanding people's lives of where they come from. You know, the emergency room just isn't about, I'm having a heart attack. There's so much more to it. And that's one of the big conversations we had a couple of days ago in one of our committees, was talking about, the misconception that runs rampant around the country of the misuse and the number of patients that, quote, don't need to be in the emergency room, when it's, you know, there's such a small percentage that are completely non-emergent stuff that doesn't need to be there. But so much more is not just that. You know, many people just diagnose, just see emergency as a heart attack, as a stroke, as a multi-system trauma, and not the rest of the stuff that we really can impact, which is that side of us that's the doctor, that's the educator, that's the teacher, that brings information to patients and education and prevention. I mean, so many people we see every day in the emergency room is because somebody didn't take the time to sit down and speak to them and educate in a way that they can understand. In what is getting translated as in the media and among all these legislators and folks around the country is we just have to get all of these patients out of the ER instead of looking at the issue, which is exactly what you're talking about with this, with diversity and inclusion, is understanding the needs of our community and the folks that are coming into our emergency room. We are absolutely a barometer of what's going on with our culture. And instead of trying to kick people out of the emergency room, I think we need to look further into why things are the way they are and what we can do to help people, not just from the science standpoint, but also from being an educator and somebody that can sit down and talk to people and try to understand what's going on with them.
That's absolutely true. We are the safety net, and we are the place that opens our arms and says, come in, and we will try to help you the best we can. And the percentage is very small of who doesn't belong in the ED, despite policymakers' conversations. But in the end, it begins far before their visit with us, and then it continues after they leave us. And so our role is that access point, that connecting point, and often sorting through some of those delicate issues, whether it be a cultural issue, whether it be abuse, whether it be trafficking of human trafficking that passes through our doors. The social issues that come through are a key portion of the services and the advocacy that we do on a day-to-day basis. And getting back to the resiliency point, it's also a tough part of the job. We see the best and the worst of society, and so it's important to realize, I think, for ourselves, that's our calling. We love emergency medicine. We feel committed to that mission, but to also realize that it's a tough mission and we're good at it, but we need to be sure to take care of ourselves on the back end as well.
How can folks get in touch with you via email, social media, or the other resources?
So my email is rparker@asep.org, and I am on Twitter at BeckyBP. So join and follow and join in the conversation. ASEP's website is asep.org. If you're interested in your chapter, put in /chapters. Our sections are /sections, and our committees are /committees, where you can find the well-being committee, the well-being section, and other resources. So I look forward to seeing everyone in D.C. in October at ASEP 17 and along on the road as I travel the country.
We'll be right back here in about 7 months or so. Yeah, 7 months, I think. So, and as for me, you can, I ask you to, like our Facebook page, ASAP Frontline. That way you know when we have a new episode. Honestly, really all you need to do is subscribe, because every Monday we're going to have a new podcast out there for you. You can also follow me along on Twitter at Everyday Med. That's at Everyday Med. And if you have any comments or suggestions, youreverydaymedicine@gmail.com. I'm Dr. Ryan Stanton, and until next time, thanks for tuning in to some ASAP Frontline.